The Shadow Out of Time by H.P. Lovecraft, Part 7. From that point forward, my impressions are scarcely to be relied upon. Indeed, I still possess a final, desperate hope that they all form parts of some demonic dream or illusion born of delirium. A fever raged in my brain, and everything came to me through a kind of haze, sometimes only intermittently. The rays of my torch shot feebly into the engulfing blackness, bringing phantasmal flashes of hideously familiar walls and carvings, all blighted with the decay of ages. In one place, a tremendous mass of vaulting had fallen, so that I had to clamber over a mighty mound of stones, reaching almost to the ragged, grotesquely stalactited roof. It was all the ultimate apex of nightmare, made worse by the blasphemous tug of pseudo-memory. One thing only was unfamiliar, and that was my own size in relation to the monstrous masonry. I felt oppressed by a sense of unwanted smallness, as if the sight of these towering walls from a mere human body was something wholly new and abnormal. Again and again I looked nervously down at myself, vaguely disturbed by the human form I possessed. Onward, through the blackness of the abyss, I leaped, plunged, and staggered, often falling and bruising myself, and once nearly shattering my torch. Every stone and corner of that demonic gulf was known to me, and at many points I stopped to cast beams of light through choked and crumbling yet familiar archways. Some rooms had totally collapsed, others were bare or debris-filled. In a few I saw masses of metal, some fairly intact, some broken, and some crushed or battered, which I recognized as the colossal pedestals or tables in my dreams. What they could in truth have been, I dared not guess. I found the downward incline and began its descent, though after a time halted by a gaping, ragged chasm whose narrowest point could not be much less than 4 feet across. Here the stonework had fallen through, revealing incalculable inky depths beneath. I knew there were two more cellar levels in this Titan edifice, and trembled with fresh panic as I recalled the metal-clamped trapdoor on the lowest one. There could be no guards now, for what had lurked beneath had long since done its hideous work and sunk into its long decline. By the time of the post-human beetle race, it would be quite dead. And yet, as I thought of the native legends, I trembled anew. It cost me a terrible effort to vault that yawning chasm, since the littered floor prevented a running start, but madness drove me on. I chose a place close to the left-hand wall, where the rift was least wide and the landing spot reasonably clear of dangerous debris, and after one frantic moment reached the other side in safety. At last gaining the lower level, I stumbled on past the archways of the Room of Machines, within which were fantastic ruins of metal, half buried beneath falling vaulting. Everything was where I knew it would be, and I climbed confidently over the heaps which barred the entrance of a vast transverse corridor. This, I realized, would take me under the city to the central archives. Endless ages seemed to unroll as I stumbled, leaped, and crawled along that debris-cluttered corridor. Now and then I could make out carvings on the age-stained walls, some familiar, others seemingly added since the period of my dreams. Since this was a subterranean house-connecting highway, there were no archways save when the route led through the lower levels of various buildings. At some of these intersections, I turned aside long enough to look down well-remembered corridors and into well-remembered rooms. Twice only did I find any radical changes from what I had dreamed of. And in one of these cases, I could trace the sealed-up outlines of the archway I remembered. I shook violently, and felt a curious surge of retarding weakness as I steered a hurried and reluctant course through the crypt of one of those great windowless ruined towers whose alien basalt masonry bespoke a whispered and horrible origin. This primal vault was round and fully 200 feet across, with nothing carved upon the dark-hued stonework. The floor was here free from anything save dust and sand, and I could see the apertures leading upward and downward. There were no stairs or inclines. Indeed, my dreams had pictured those elder towers as wholly untouched by the fabulous great race. Those who had built them had not needed stairs or inclines. In the dreams, the downward aperture had been tightly sealed and nervously guarded. Now it lay open, black and yawning, and giving forth a current of cool, damp air. Of what limitless caverns of eternal night might brood below, I would not permit myself to think. Later, clawing my way along a badly heaped section of the corridor, I reached a place where the roof had wholly caved in. The debris rose like a mountain, and I climbed up over it, passing through a vast empty space where my torchlight could reveal neither walls nor vaulting. This, I reflected, must be the cellar of the House of the Metal Purveyors, fronting on the third square, not far from the archives. What had happened to it, I could not conjecture. I found the corridor again beyond the mountain of detritus and stones, but after a short distance encountered a wholly choked place where the fallen vaulting almost touched the perilously sagging ceiling. How I managed to wrench and tear aside enough blocks to afford a passage, and how I dared disturb the tightly packed fragments when the least shift of equilibrium might have brought down all the tons of superincumbent masonry to crush me to nothingness, I do not know. It was sheer madness that impelled me and guided me. If, indeed, my whole underground adventure was not, as I hope, a hellish delusion or phase of dreaming. But I did make, or dream that I made, a passage that I could squirm through. As I wriggled over the mound of debris, my torch, switched continuously on, thrust deeply within my mouth, I felt myself torn by the fantastic stalactites of the jagged floor above me. I was now close to the great underground archival structure which seemed to form my goal. Sliding and clambering down the farther side of the barrier and picking my way along the remaining stretch of corridor with hand-held, intermittently flashing torch, I came at last to a low, circular crypt with arches, still in a marvelous state of preservation, opening off on every side. The walls, or such parts of them as lay within reach of my torchlight, were densely hieroglyphed and chiseled with typical curvilinear symbols, some added since the period of my dreams. This, I realized, was my fated destination, and I turned at once through a familiar archway on my left. That I could find a clear passage up and down the incline to all the surviving levels, I had oddly little doubt. This vast, earth-protected pile housing the annals of all the solar system had been built with a supernal skill and strength to last as long as that system itself. Blocks of stupendous size, poised with mathematical genius and bound with cements of incredible toughness, had combined to form a mass as firm as the planet's rocky core. Here, after ages more prodigious than I could sanely grasp, its buried bulk stood in all its essential contours. The vast, dust-drifted floors scarce sprinkled with the litter elsewhere so dominant. The relatively easy walking from this point onward went curiously to my head. All the frantic eagerness hitherto frustrated by obstacles now took itself out in a kind of febrile speed, and I literally raced along the low-roofed, monstrously well-remembered aisles beyond the archway. I was past being astonished by the familiarity of what I saw. On every hand, the great hieroglyphed metal shelf doors loomed monstrously. Some yet in place, others sprung open, and still others bent and buckled under bygone geological stresses not quite strong enough to shatter the Titan masonry. Here and there, a dust-covered heap below a gaping, empty shelf seemed to indicate where cases had been shaken down by earth tremors. On occasion, pillars were great symbols of letters proclaiming classes and subclasses of volumes. Once I paused before an open vault, where I saw some of the accustomed metal cases still in position amidst the omnipresent gritty dust. Reaching up, I dislodged one of the thinner specimens with some difficulty and rested it on the floor for inspection. It was titled in the prevailing curvilinear hieroglyphs, though something in the arrangement of the characters seemed subtly unusual. The odd mechanism of the hooked fastener was perfectly well known to me, and I snapped up the still, rustless, and workable lid, and drew out the book within. The latter, as expected, was some 20 by 15 inches in area, and 2 inches thick. The thin metal covers opening at the top, its tough cellulose pages seemed unaffected by the myriad cycles of time they had lived through, and I studied the queerly pigmented, brush-drawn letters of the text. Symbols utterly unlike either the usual curved hieroglyphs or any alphabet known to human scholarship. With a haunting, half-aroused memory, it came to me that this was the language used by a captive mind I had known slightly in my dreams, a mind from a large asteroid on which had survived much of the archaic life and lore of the primal planet whereof it formed a fragment. At the same time, I recalled that this level of the archives was devoted to volumes dealing with the non-terrestrial planets. As I ceased poring over the incredible document, I saw that the light of my torch was beginning to fail, hence quickly inserted the extra battery I always had with me. Then, armed with stronger radiance, I resumed my feverish racing through unending tangles of aisles and corridors, recognizing now and then some familiar shelf and vaguely annoyed by the acoustic conditions which made my footfalls echo incongruously in these catacombs of eon-long death and silence. The very prints of my shoes behind me in the millennially untrodden dust made me shudder. Never before, if my mad dreams held anything of truth, had human feet pressed upon those immemorial pavements. Of the particular goal of my insane racing, my conscious mind held no hint. There was, however, some force of evil potency pulling at my dazed will and buried recollection, so that I vaguely felt I was not running at random. I came to a downward incline and followed it to profounder depths. Floors flashed by me as I raced, but I did not pause to explore them. In my whirling brain there had begun to beat a certain rhythm which set my right hand twitching in unison. I wanted to unlock something, and felt that I knew all the intricate twists and pressures needed to do it. It would be like a modern safe with a combination lock. Dream or not, I had once known, and still knew, how any dream or scrap of unconsciously absorbed legend could have taught me such a detail, so minute, so intricate, and so complex, I did not attempt to explain to myself. I was beyond all coherent thought, for was not this whole experience, this shocking familiarity with a set of unknown rules, and this monstrously exact identity of everything before me, with what the dreams and scraps of myth could have suggested, a horror beyond all reason? Probably it was my basic conviction then, as is now during my saner moments, that I was not awake at all, and that the entire buried city was a fragment of febrile hallucination. Eventually, I reached the lowest level and struck off to the right of the incline. For some shadowy reason, I tried to soften my steps, even though I lost speed thereby. There was a space I was afraid to cross on this last deeply buried floor, and as I drew near it, I recalled what thing in that space I feared. It was merely one of the metal-barred and closely guarded trapdoors. There would be no guards now, and on that account I trembled and tiptoed as I had done in passing through the black basalt vault where a similar trapdoor had yawned. I felt a current of cool, damp air, as I had felt there, and wished that my course led in another direction. Why I had to take the particular course I was taking, I did not know. When I came to the space, I saw that the trapdoor yawned widely open. Ahead, the shelves began again, and I glimpsed on the floor before one of them a heap very thinly covered with dust, where a number of cases had recently fallen. At the same moment, a fresh wave of panic clutched me, though for some time I could not discover why. Heaps of fallen cases were not uncommon, for all through the eons this lightless labyrinth had been racked by the heavings of earth and had echoed at intervals to the deafening clatter of toppling objects. It was only when I was nearly across the space that I realized why I shook so violently. Not the heap, but something about the dust of the level floor was troubling me. In the light of my torch, it seemed as if that dust was not as even as it ought to be. There were places where it looked thinner, as if it had been disturbed not many months before. I could not be sure, for even the apparently thinner places were dusty enough, yet a certain suspicion of regularity in the fancied unevenness was highly disquieting. When I brought the torchlight close to one of the queer places, I did not like what I saw, for the illusion of regularity became very great. It was as if there were regular lines of composite impressions, impressions that went in threes, each slightly over a foot square, and consisting of five nearly circular 3-inch prints, one in advance of the other four. These possible lines of foot-square impressions appeared to lead in two directions, as if something had gone somewhere and returned. They were, of course, very faint, and may have been illusions or accidents, but there was an element of dim, fumbling terror about the way I thought they ran. For at the end of them was a heap of cases which must have clattered down not long before, while at the other end was the ominous trap-door, with the cool, damp wind yawning unguarded down to the abysses past imagination. End of part 7.